This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind zurück beim Spitzenspiel zwischen Einnahmen und Ausgaben. Es bleibt spannend. Gutschrift zu Bonus, Bonus und da taucht plötzlich Spesenerstattung auf. Schuss! Oh, in letzter Sekunde hält der Notgroschen.
Finanzen werden nie so spannend sein wie Fußball, aber wir geben unser Bestes. Konto, Geschäftskonto, Unternehmensgründung, Buchhaltung.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Hello. Thank you for downloading the Briefing Room podcast presented by me, David Aronovich. And don't worry, I'm going to save you from fast-forwarding and keep the chat brief this week. So on with the show. 6 months ago, the lockdown was announced in Britain. 6 months that feels like years. This week, I want to know what we've learned in that 6 months about the virus itself, about its effects on the human body, and about how best to control its transmission. What's changed? Step into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. First, what do we now know about COVID-19, the spiky beast that has killed more than 40,000 of us here in the UK since February? And how has our knowledge evolved? Ravi Gupta is Professor of Microbiology at the University of Cambridge, where he specialises in immunology and infectious diseases. Professor Gupta, what were you up to around about the time that COVID-19 first emerged?
So back in February of this year, I was in fact preparing to go to the large HIV conference that's held in Boston every other year. I was going to present the London patient, who was the individual who we demonstrated cure in, and he was the second person ever to be cured. And I was going to be presenting the latest data on that individual.
And that didn't happen?
No. In fact, the meeting was cancelled due to coronavirus emerging and the sort of shutdown that ensued.
Now, you've since then become something of an expert on COVID-19. Did a lot of people, essentially, scientists like you, essentially have to retool as coronavirus became a big issue?
Yes, I think many of us thought that given our skill sets and our experience, certainly with viruses such as HIV for ourselves, we were compelled in a way to try and answer some of the questions that were going to emerge, given that we knew virtually nothing about this virus at the time.
Now, what's base one that you have to cover when you have a new virus? What's the first thing you have to establish?
Well, the first thing you want to know is what type of virus is this? And that's usually done by genetics and sequencing of a virus to know which family it has come from. And that was done very early on in China. And it was found to be a coronavirus related to the Middle East respiratory virus and also related to the original SARS-1 virus.
What have you discovered, what's been discovered about the virus since then?
So this was a really important and worrying aspect of the epidemic initially. People wondered whether this virus, which was bad enough as it was, would actually become more pathogenic, in other words, cause more severe disease as time went on, or it would become more transmissible over time because of this concept of mutation. And mutation is something that happens in every living being. It's the result of the fact that when an organism tries to reproduce itself, it needs to make an extra set of copies of its genetic material. And the enzymes or the protein complexes that do that make mistakes sometimes, and that generates these mutations. And because of Darwinian selection, some of these mutations are beneficial for that individual and will enable it or its offspring to colonize a niche or do better or survive certain adverse conditions. And we were very interested in what was happening. And one particular mutation emerged in the spike protein called D614G that allowed the virus to become more highly transmissible, we believe, because this mutation arose and pretty much became the dominant form of the virus within a matter of months.
So in other words, it actually became more infectious almost while we were looking at it.
That's right. It happened very, very quickly in global terms. And for example, in the early days of the epidemic here, we had a potentially a 50-50 split between the normal virus and the mutated version. And as time went on, it became greater than 90% of all the infections that we were seeing.
Was there any difference in the seriousness, what you call the pathogenic nature of that mutation, or were they pretty much the same?
There hasn't been any evidence for the newer virus or the mutated form being more deadly or more serious than the original or what we call wild type. And that's really important, of course. But we do think it's more transmissible. There are some in vitro studies in the laboratory that show when you make the mutation, the virus is able to replicate itself at a higher rate.
In the early days of the virus, there was a lot of discussion, in fact, there still is sometimes, around herd immunity, the idea that if a high percentage of the population or a significant percentage of the population contracted a virus, they would then become immune and that would protect the wider population. Do we have any idea whether or not there is such a thing as herd immunity when it comes to COVID-19?
So this was a concept, as you say, that was really emphasised at the beginning. And herd immunity for viral infections classically is an important thing. The problem with coronaviruses is that we know that you can be infected year after year with coronaviruses from similar strains in the same family, suggesting to us that your immunity, your individual immunity, waxes and wanes depending on infection. And we're not really sure why you lose immunity, whether it's the virus mutating or whether it's something about the virus-induced immunity that is not as robust. But in any case, I think the concept of herd immunity to coronavirus is a very problematic one, and I don't think that we should be applying the concept of herd immunity just yet until we understand more about how long immunity to SARS-CoV-2 lasts. So we really need more information as to what type of immunity we're getting, how long it lasts in individuals, before we can discuss herd immunity.
Okay, so what do you think the most significant thing that you have learned about this virus since March?
I think that a really critical and novel and surprising thing about this virus is this duration of disease. I mean, I've not seen many infections apart, you know, things like HIV, where a virus can cause a chronic infection that gets progressively worse. You either get an infection and it clears, or you get a chronic viral infection like hepatitis B or HIV that kind of gradually overwhelms you or causes disease. But this is a virus infection that causes an initial illness that in some people progresses. And the second phase is thought to be due to an overactive immune response. And that really is a novel and an unexpected finding. So I think that's been one of the most important things about this disease.
Professor Ravi Gupta, who with his last answer takes us into how our knowledge of the effects of the virus on us has changed. So let's dig further into that. Tim Spector is Professor of Genetic Epidemiology at King's College London, where they've developed a COVID symptom tracking app, which over 4 million people, including me, have signed up to. Tim Spector, if you cast your mind back to January, what were your expectations then of the COVID-19 virus and how it might affect the people who caught it?
Back in January, everyone was told this was a Chinese flu and would possibly be something like SARS or affect small numbers of people in quite severely. And a few cases might get to Europe, but it probably would peter out. It wasn't something that if you were fairly healthy, you should be worried about.
Now, what information was that diagnosis based on, if you cast your mind back?
This really was just reports coming out of China. There had been this outbreak, it had been contained, and that most of the people who were dying were either hospital staff or were elderly or people with problems and wasn't going to travel everywhere. But it was definitely labelled as a flu, and there were only two symptoms, you know, this fever and this cough.
How did our understanding of the symptoms change at the moment when you could tell when someone had this thing without actually testing them?
There were a few anecdotal reports from hospitals, particularly in Italy, that said that as well as the fever and the cough, a lot of the sick people had reported a wider range of symptoms, which started to arouse suspicion, but no one was doing any serious investigations of that. And there were reports of people, even after they had left hospital, having lost, you know, sense of smell and other strange things like this, that people didn't know if it was serious or not.
And so how long did it take for us to realise that there were really a whole range of symptoms associated with this that we hadn't initially understood?
Well, I think it was our symptom app that was the only survey going on that was recording people's symptoms every day in real time that first alerted us to this fact, because we very rapidly included on the app a much wider range of symptoms than the government was asking. And that's really when we first learned that the first major one, this loss of smell and taste, anosmia, was affecting a lot of people soon after we'd launched the app. And that was the first sign that we ought to really focus on a lot of these other symptoms, So we used these symptoms as an algorithm, and this was in a way a virtual swab test. And that's how we started to get the numbers together and work out which symptoms were common and which were, if you like, very specific to the virus that wouldn't be confused with other diseases.
Right. So now let's talk about how many different symptoms you think you have now confirmed.
The commonest symptom is actually severe fatigue. And about 80% of people who have a positive swab test seem to have this at all ages. Then severe headaches is another one. You've got sore throat and muscle pains, skin rashes, which occur in about 1 in 6 children and 1 in 12 adults. You've got various other complaints of the gastrointestinal system. So people very commonly just go off their food very rapidly. The list really includes most bits of the body, and some of them are more predictive of a positive test than others. But the thing we've really learned is if you don't have the common ones, you're unlikely to have COVID. And so the fact that 80% of people have either this really severe fatigue or headache, I think, is really important. Most people don't have a temperature with COVID.
So almost all these temperature control things that we've got on all these buildings are not terribly useful.
They're a placebo. They're a waste of time because you also only get temperature for a couple of days at most. It's much less useful than having, you know, some coffee brewing and asking people, can they smell it?
Are there the same significant differences between age groups and conditions when it comes to the severity of the illness as there is with deaths, or is it different?
Well, there's different patterns of disease at different ages. So children who get it very mildly have very little in the way of chest symptoms compared to adults. And that isn't well recognised. And that's why we have this epidemic at the moment of people saying they think their child has got COVID because they've got a cough and a fever and a runny nose. But actually, that's just a cold. Whereas in the elderly, they get a different range of symptoms. And neither the young or the elderly get the loss of smell as much.
What have we learned about susceptibility as a result either of ethnicity or of the differences that ethnicity can give rise to?
Well, just from our app, we've shown that there are increased rates of infection and severity in non-European minority groups in the UK and the US. And we can't explain that with the common risk factors like diabetes, obesity, or areas of deprivation. You know, it's still possible that the socioeconomic factors play a role. And so I don't think we know exactly why ethnicity is important. But when you look globally, I'm struck how people in India or in favelas in Brazil, who might have similar ethnicities to some of the people here, get very little in the way of symptoms because their environment where they're surrounded by microbes perhaps is helping their immune systems, whereas those same races in a poor area in the UK will do very badly. And so perhaps there are other factors involved that interacts with our immune system that we don't understand. So I don't think anyone really understands this ethnicity difference yet.
Now, you described an incredibly complex virus with complex effects compared with other viruses. As far as you know, are there any implications for vaccines and finding successful vaccines as a consequence of that complexity?
From the moment we saw the different range of responses, and we've also done work with antibodies as well. So we know that the way people produce antibodies differs as well. So there isn't a standard way you respond to it, either in the immune system or in the symptoms. That unpredictability suggests that there might be lots of different ways we react to the virus. Given that, I think it's going to make it much harder to find a vaccine that's going to suit everybody. And that does worry me that we may need lots of different vaccines or different approaches or put people into categories of their response to then allocate vaccines. It's not going to be straightforward. And that's why I'm not as optimistic as some people about having a killer vaccine that works for everybody.
Professor Tim Spector holding out the prospect that the virus could be with us for some time, which brings the spotlight back to policies and behaviours aiming to mitigate its impact. So far, which have helped and which have hindered? My final guests in the briefing room are Thomas Hale, Associate Professor of Global Public Policy at the University of Oxford, and Keith Neal, Emeritus Professor of Infectious Diseases at the University of Nottingham. Thomas Hale, at Oxford, you've been tracking the policies introduced by various governments around the world. Which ones do you think have had the most positive impact in terms of controlling the virus?
The first months of the pandemic show very clearly two things. First, that strong action matters, and second, that early action matters. So stopping people from being in contact with other people does really reduce the spread of the disease. And to cite just one example, one study showed that even just a week delay in adopting stringent measures would lead to 70% more deaths over time. Now, that makes sense because the disease is spread by contact between people. So to break the chain of transmission, you need to stop people gathering, especially in closed, confined spaces. But what we have yet to pin down, to my mind, is the most important question, is what is that magic formula where we get the biggest health benefit for the least disruption? And how does that magic formula, that package of policies, vary across different contexts?
As far as you can see looking at it, which countries have had the most successful magic formula? In other words, which have most successfully both managed to control the disease and to have minimum disruption? Is there such a place?
Well, an analytic difficulty for us is that in the first months of the pandemic, most countries did mostly the same things at mostly the same time, and indeed in mostly the same order. So we hear a lot in the news about different kinds of exceptions. You know, Sweden is often held up as a country that took a slightly different approach, but most countries actually followed a pretty similar pattern that makes it hard for us to pin down exactly the effect of any individual policy on the spread of the disease. And this sequencing was really quite common across countries. So, you know, first they would introduce travel restrictions, then information campaigns, then school and workplace closings, and only then harder measures like stay-at-home orders or business shutdowns. And as they've unwound those policies, they've also unwound them in a similar pattern. So as we go forward, we need to really think more about how to design research to unlock exactly the effect of an individual policy, as opposed to this package that is what we've seen so far. So it's improving, but we're still not in a confident way to be able to say globally, this is the policy that really matters.
Now, are there any policies adopted in any particular countries which we can now say with a relative degree of certainty didn't really work and haven't had a useful impact?
One I would hold up from the early months is the approach countries took to international travel controls. Countries really struggled to put in place an effective system to manage the risk of importing and exporting cases, because most countries put in place travel controls basically already after the virus was spreading locally, and so weren't obviously very good at keeping the virus out of the door. Some countries have done that okay. They've put in place systems, for example, to require all people entering a jurisdiction to be isolated until they can be tested and deemed safe. But what we really need for that going forward is a coordinated system where countries can trust that other countries are sending them people who have already been screened for risk.
Keith Neal, let's talk about policies designed to cut infection rates. Do we know more now about how the virus transmits than we did back in March and how our policies are able to impact upon transmission?
We do know from the further you are away from people, the less likely to catch, and that really comes to applying common sense. But to get infected, it actually can be quite difficult, given that someone who is infectious may be meeting hundreds of people a day, particularly in inner cities, and they're not infecting everybody they meet. Every disease that we've known, infectious disease-wise, some people are more susceptible than others. And I think for people spreading it, I think I'm more keen to look at super spreading events rather than super spreader people. There's been a well-reported wedding in Georgia where the father of the bride had symptoms and hugged and kissed and shook hands with large numbers of people out who were there and infected 120 people. It's quite clear that a few people spread the infection more than others, while others do not spread it at all. Classically, that is well demonstrated in household transmission, where someone who develops symptoms, the people they live with only appear to have at most a sort of 1 in 3 chance of acquiring and being infected with the virus. And that's prolonged close contact occurs.
Now, one big policy that we've introduced in the more recent times has been the introduction of masks in shops and on public transport. Has there been any useful, good research into the effects of masks on helping stop the spread of coronavirus? And if there has, what does it say?
I think my view on masks has changed over the course of the last 6 months. Some of the evidence we were using was based on what we know about flu. And Southeast Asia has far more mask wearing than we do in the Western Europe, yet they still suffer from flu to the same degree. So quite clearly that all those people wearing paper masks in Japan is not interrupting flu transmission. One paper I saw looked at death rates in Europe, and they found 3 factors that predicted the total number of deaths by country. It showed that obesity increasing age, a number of the percentage of your population over 80, and how much community mask wearing were the three predictors of the death rate. And I think it may come down to the fact that if this is droplets and people are wearing masks, then the droplets don't go very far. So the lower infectious dose leads to mild disease. So wearing a mask, I think, is well worth doing to protect yourself.
Tom Hale, policies are obviously only good if the public actually obeys them. What can we say about how compliant we in the UK have been, and how do we compare in compliance to other countries?
So the overall pattern in the UK, and actually globally, is pretty good. Most people's behaviour has really changed in the last few months, and most people follow most of the rules most of the time. The UK is kind of in the upper quartile of countries in terms of change in behaviour. So that's a pretty good result. Most of the differences are not really between countries, but between different parts of society. So, for example, we see riskier behavior in men as opposed to women, and in young people rather than old people. And also in some countries, some riskier behavior correlated with different kinds of political ideologies.
One of the assumptions that was made, apparently, back in February, was that it would be difficult to get the UK population to be compliant in stringent measures. And the orthodoxy now is that that was proved to be wrong, and actually British people are compliant, but we become less compliant over time. Is that borne out?
I think it is. So across all countries, we see a general erosion of compliance over time, driven by a range of factors, probably, like fatigue with complying with all these measures all the time, also perhaps by a lower perception of risk and other kinds of factors as well.
Where have we seen those struggles at their sharpest? Because it's pretty obvious that as you try to move out of total lockdown, the most simple position, then all these things begin to change. You want to encourage some people to go back to work, but you also want to encourage them to be compliant in social distancing. Where can we say that's working, and where can we say it might not be working, and can we say why?
In a paucity of evidence where the situation is changing quite quickly, sort of common sense rules of thumb are probably the best ones to follow. So, for example, a lot of governments have tried to introduce economic stimulus policies to restart parts of the economy in a targeted way. Here in the UK, for example, we've seen a lot of effort into Eat Out to help out, to get people to use restaurants to support jobs in the hospitality sector. That had some positive benefits for restaurants, of course, but it was designed in a way that maybe wasn't ideal for maintaining social distancing. Because if you remember, you could get the discount only on certain days of the week, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Tuesdays. That meant that we saw people going to restaurants more on those days and less maybe on the other days. So, you know, a well-intentioned scheme, but one which probably had an unintended side effect of putting more people together than would have been ideal.
Keith Neal, that is quite a common charge, actually, which is that people get very confused about what appears to be conflicting information. Don't gather in groups more than six, but do carry on working. Go back to school. Obviously, people more than six do use public transport. Carriages full of people. Get on planes, totally full of people. What is the sense of these overall package of measures where there seem to be those contradictions?
I think one thing is household transmission is one of the main routes of transmission, and it seems to be fueling quite a lot of our outbreaks within the United Kingdom. So anything that reduces household transmission is going to have significant impact on the overall success of the virus spreading. In places where work, school and pubs, they've enforced some form of social distancing and tables are separated, and it's quite likely that you can have significant reduction in transmission possibilities. And you mentioned airlines. We know from most other infectious outbreaks on airlines, it's actually only the people who are at risk are the people who sit very close. Because although people think about the air being circulated, it is, but there are very good filters to stop the spread of viruses on airlines. So it appears to be contradictory, but it's within the science that we know and understand.
But is there then any scientific basis for, let's say, six rather than eight or four? Or is it just you've got to choose a number and that looks like quite a good one?
I think that sums it up quite nicely. You can make an argument either way, but essentially, if somebody cheats and makes it seven, then it's not going to be the end of the world. If you start getting up to 10, 11, 12 in a house, that seriously starts increasing the risk two ways. One, you markedly reduce distancing. And if you're with 10 people, there are 9 people who might infect you. With 5 people, there's only 4 people who could infect you. That's half the risk.
Well, Thomas, would you agree with that?
I would agree. Look, these are hard lines to draw. And even though it maybe doesn't make sense to ban one thing and not the other thing, the overall goal is to reduce the total number of contacts, particularly the most risky ones. So I can sympathize with a government that says, well, we could shut down pubs, which are providing economic revenue, providing jobs, or we could shut down house parties, which are providing the same function, but without those economic benefits. Even though the risk might be similar across them, say it was, you know, there's a pretty clear case, I think, for taking one choice and not the other there.
Thanks, Tom. I want to throw you a question which pushes forwards very slightly for us, and that's students returning to university. Other countries have already seen students return. I think the US universities are back. What are we learning from these experiences?
Our team has been following the U.S. experience very closely, and it's giving us a major cause for concern, actually, because there's been some spectacular failures. So, for example, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a big university, 30,000 students, took a pretty aggressive approach towards social distancing, requiring all sorts of restrictions on what students could do and how full buildings could be, et cetera. But in the first week that students were there, the number of people who test positive went from 2.8% to 13.6% in a single week. So, you know, nearly a factor of five increase in just 7 days. That's pretty terrifying. And what's really worrying is that even universities that took a really ambitious approach were not immune to these kinds of negative outcomes. So the University of Illinois, a massive public university of 40,000 students, was actually testing all of those students twice a week. And to get into a building, they had to scan an app on their phone that was connected to their test results. So it was a pretty good, robust policy. What that didn't account for, though, is that some students actually, after testing positive and being told they had to isolate, went to parties anyway. So you had a small number of non-compliant actors who really scuppered even the best laid plans.
Is there any way we can isolate the rest of ourselves from university students?
An important question that I'm sure that people of Oxford think about on a regular basis. look, I think we can't really separate any sector of society from each other. We are really all in this together. People, students working, going to university are interacting with people working there, people working there interacting with people in their homes and in their social circles. So no, we can't carve off a sector of the society and say, you're on your own now. We're really all in this together, which is why I think promoting policies and behaviors that draw on and play to that sense of solidarity is really a key ingredient for success.
Okay. I suppose one thing that could follow from that is the question about whether, if you discover, as we might, that the transmission rate is going very, very high again, is there such a thing as a quick national lockdown? Let's say a kind of 2 week or 3 week R-busting lockdown that you can put in place?
It might be that we'll end up having to have restrictive situations like we are seeing now in the Northeast later on today, that this will become necessary. But there are certain things I think that we don't need to include, particularly things like outside activities. We restricted people's exercise when in fact these had minimal levels of risk. So what we experienced back in April probably doesn't need to be reflected into the same degree, but something similar for a few weeks, maybe a bit longer, and then relaxing again until we get a vaccine.
Keith Neal there with Thomas Hale. And my summary, coronavirus, work in progress, now and for some time to come. Thank you to my guests, Ravi Gupta, Tim Spector, Thomas Hale and Keith Neal. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith, Kirstine Knight and Julie Ball. Our studio manager is Rod Farker and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast and you're new to The Briefing Room, then do take a look through our archive. This year, we've taken a really deep dive into the coronavirus pandemic, looking at how it's affected the NHS, the economy and our mental health. We've also asked if a return to schools is a good idea and how China's relations with other countries has changed since the emergence of the virus. You can find all those episodes and much, much more on the BBC Sounds app.